You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of God Complex by Zoe Bernard. Silicon Valley is now cultivating projects that embolden a vision slightly grander than that of subscription software. And these projects will be helmed not by some anemic ayahuasca-drinking softie, but by a new kind of entrepreneur, a serious person with a serious vision for the future. The Valley's most powerful venture capitalists are seeking entrepreneurs with the fire in the eyes, the ferocity of speech and action that is the physical manifestation of seriousness, writes Catherine Boyle, a partner at Andreessen Horowitz and co-founder of the firm's American Dynamism practice. No one wants the Palantir guy to be high on acid for 2 weeks at Burning Man, said that same venture capital communications exec. You want hard workers, people who are like, I learned that at West Point. We have Israelis who served in the IDF and are religious and conservative and super libertarian, and we're like, yeah, that seems focused. We'll take that. That venture capitalists are seeking a new sort of entrepreneur is an expectation felt palpably among the many aspiring founders at the Code and Cosmos event, who, you get the sense, have businesses that are so far made up of a single pitch deck. You could see it in the gaggle of young, obviously elated entrepreneurial would-bes surrounding Tan, faces beaming, eager to make small talk about Christianity with one of Silicon Valley's leading investors. Thank you for saving San Francisco, a woman gushed, referring to Tan's recent involvement in San Francisco politics. He smiled and nodded. The founders encircled Tan ever closer, until he was completely surrounded and backed against the wall. They began at first with inquiries relating to Tan's talk, which spanned from the imminent arrival of an omniscient superintelligence to why we should deregulate its use. We're criminalizing something that's basically doing matrix multiplication, to the importance of attending church. Pleasantries now out of the way, the founders got down to business. They asked Tan if he would connect with them on LinkedIn. He did. They asked for selfies. He obliged. And then, one by one, his hopeful disciples pitched their startups. I'd like to tell you about my company, they said. And Tan, listening on with an air of pointed graciousness that was indeed Christ-like, continued his smiling and nodding, followed by variations on the reply, that's a good idea, do you have any customers? Or interesting concept, do you have customers? Invariably, the founders' faces fell, a newfound sheepishness creeping into their voices as they replied, no, or not yet, but soon. And Tan would say, reach out again when you have customers. And then he would move on to the next founder. This went on for at least half an hour, eventually becoming so monotonous that I wondered how any venture capitalist might have the patience, much less the optimism, for any real innovation. And I stepped away. In the cutthroat world of venture funding, founders are often taught to have a competitive advantage, or what the industry calls an edge, against their peers. When Thiel said in 2015 that many of Silicon Valley's successful entrepreneurs seem to have a mild form of Asperger's, overnight, kids started putting on an autism effect to seem smarter, one entrepreneur recalled. Like you're not on the spectrum, you're just socially awkward, and you're trying to seem smart. These days, he argued, the same effect that engendered a class of people putting on neurodivergence is cultivating a new bent toward biblical altruism. This could be especially appealing to anyone seeking to stand out in a monoculture in which polycules and ketamine are mundane, but attending Sunday church service is subversive. You know, in cities like San Francisco and New York, being a Christian is a little bit of a vice, said a San Francisco consultant. In other words, the new religion is religion. One Y Combinator-backed entrepreneur told me, with obvious distaste, how Bookface, Y Combinator's internal social network, has lately filled up with pro-Christian messaging. It is, as Arjun Sethi, the co-CEO of the cryptocurrency exchange platform Kraken, said, only the latest prototype in a system crowded by identity politics. It's surface. It's a fad, he said. I think they are trying to replace ESG, the socially conscious investing principle that prioritizes environmental, social, and governance issues with Christianity. I guarantee you, one Christian entrepreneur told me, there are people that are leveraging Christianity to get closer to Peter Thiel. This is a reality not lost on Michelle Stevens, the founder of Acts 17 Collective, who is well aware that Silicon Valley kingmakers might lure potential acolytes to Christian-adjacent events. In fact, it seemed that this is sort of the point of her organization. People in tech are fundamentally motivated by money, fame, and power, Stevens said. People with a lot of clout or business acumen and cred is how you get them in the door. These events are a collision of godliness and good old-fashioned hedonism. Amid caviar bumps and champagne, you might find yourself shoulder to shoulder with someone like Thiel, who is, as Stevens points out, a gay billionaire, and who at Act 17 Collective's pilot event in May spoke at length about his relationship with Jesus Christ. These juxtapositions highlight that Christianity doesn't have to look a certain way, she said. The Jesus we know isn't the Jesus of religion. He is the Jesus of the people, for the people. Honest Christianity, despite what you may have learned or heard, is a radically inclusive faith. Silicon Valley's Christian awakening has no physical center, but one downtown San Francisco church, Epic, is gaining traction among the tech crowd. Its lead pastor is a lovely guy called Ben Pilgreen, who told me over the phone that post-pandemic, his congregation grew from 300 to more than 800. In a city that's renowned for being spectacularly godless, the surge of interest is surprising, he added, but not entirely unexpected. I think COVID did something to us, said Pilgreen. I'm still not sure about everything it did to us as a society or individuals, but it called people to think about what matters. It helps, too, that Epic Church hosts a series dedicated to people working in Silicon Valley's centers of innovation, CEOs and venture capitalists who regularly speak about how technology can be used in the glory of God. There's an ideological compatibility with the capitalist-friendly notion that each person has a calling and a vocation, and using your gifts to the max is a good thing, and it's what God would want, said Toby Kurth, a pastor who has headed Bible studies attended by Thiel. Or, as Daniel Francis, the Catholic founder of the AI startup Able, put it, you have a duty as a founder to make really good products and get them into people's hands. You're making God real in people's lives when they experience that. Next photo, House of Worship. Ben Pilgreen is the founder and lead pastor of Epic, a non-denominational church that's gaining major traction among San Francisco's tech set. Implicit in Silicon Valley's religious fervor are its recent investments in serious people with serious visions, which accounts for the billions lately plowed into defense tech and artificial intelligence. Such fields raise big, nagging questions about not only morality, but the nature of the human condition. Why is the Western view superior? Is it ethical to assert military dominance over other nations, if machines replicate human intelligence, and by extension consciousness, what will account for our species' exceptionalism? These are catechisms you can easily complete with a Protestant perspective. The United States is superior because it is a nation founded on the Bible, despite what the Constitution may assert about the separation of church and state. Our country has a moral obligation to assert global dominance in order to spread biblical values around the world. And humans are special because we are the pinnacle of God's creation. This religious framework fortifies other vexing existential concerns as well, including the lingering sense that the technology industry writ large maybe isn't such a great thing after all. Lately, a new, more thoughtful strain has entered my conversations with founders who express their off-the-record misgivings about the technology they themselves are building. These dialogues seem sincere in a way that is a frankly refreshing and novel reversal from the discussions I had with many of these same formerly fresh-faced entrepreneurs who pitched their startups with bald enthusiasm only a few years earlier. They say the tech industry can no longer rely, as it did in the mid-2010s, on the uncomplicated notion that it is making the world a better place. Everyone hates tech now, a venture capitalist recently told me, looking vaguely self-conscious as he said it. For any principled technologist who may feel their industry is a wellspring of confusion and despair, it's comforting to believe that God created people to make cool products, and that making cool products actually is a good thing. Another idea gaining steam among some of the Silicon Valley faithful is the notion that tech is not an inherent evil. Rather, tech produced by bad thinking, and by extension secular thinking, is. This was the general theory floated by entrepreneur Reggie James in October at Hereticon, a Founders Fund-backed conference for creative dissidents. During its apocalypse-themed Miami gathering, Thiel spoke about the coming of the Antichrist. There, James introduced the idea of secutech, or secular technology, designed from a secular perspective. His primary example is social media, which he told me over the phone engenders the postmodernist values of fighting over identity and representation. Everyone on social media is going through an identity crisis and some kind of disinformation campaign. That's not a bug, that's a feature of postmodern design. There is an antidote to secutech, says James, and it's called spiritual technology, which is technology that, while not necessarily relying on a religious framework, is built with the understanding that values across religions are different from postmodernist secular tech values. But not every religious technologist is necessarily all in on Silicon Valley's burgeoning embrace of Christianity. Luke Burgess, a Catholic entrepreneur who recently hosted a dinner at the Vatican dealing with AI, said there's a danger in trying to map Christianity onto everything that Silicon Valley is doing. This is the goal, Burgess noted, of the 1626 novel The New Atlantis, which has piqued the interest of some Silicon Valley circles. The novel envisions a secretive, quasi-Christian society that through technological experiments controls the weather, overcomes aging, and builds heaven on earth. These godlike efforts are at work in industries like defense tech, which Burgess warned is such brilliant branding because it's not always used that way. But, he added, there's also artificial superintelligence, which is the idea that machines will soon compete with and eventually supersede human intelligence. In Silicon Valley, said Burgess, there's a strong strain in which they are trying to create something that would take the place of a god. Few people have fueled that anxiety on the same order as Sam Altman, the OpenAI co-founder, who believes that AI will usher in massive prosperity, as he wrote in one essay, and make us capable of doing things that would have seemed like magic to our grandparents. From the stage at Code and Cosmos, Tan tells us how only yesterday he spent 5 hours talking with Altman, whose treatise, he said with shining eyes, is almost a work of faith itself of AGI and ASI potentially in thousands of days. Tan continues, Sam thinks we will actually unlock physics and the secrets of science and technology to a point where we will have abundance on tap. Some of what Tan had been getting at on stage reminded me of those Silicon Valley technologists that Burgess warned me about, the ones who are so eager to manufacture their own god. And admittedly, at one point in the reporting of this story, I started down a highly cynical, conspiratorial line of thought that some people in Silicon Valley, like Tan, were cloaking their ambitions to build a god under the guise of traditional religion, like a 21st century version of Joseph Smith, with a direct line to a godlike intelligence that performs technological miracles. I posited to Eliezer Yudkowsky, the co-founder of the Thiel-backed Machine Intelligence Research Institute, who has warned that the unchecked development of superintelligent machines will result in humanity's certain extinction. Yudkowsky was quick to throw cold water on that idea, arguing that religious thinking has little utility in uncovering the motivations and stakes of AI. At the core of everything, there's a factual question. How much power does AI end up with in the limit? Can its makers control it? He told me. You can't settle it by religious thinking. You can't settle it by accusing other people of religious thinking. If someone could actually build a god for $20 billion and have it follow their orders, they wouldn't need to be religious to want to do that. When I took Tan aside to ask why he thought a Christian perspective was relevant to anyone working on artificial intelligence, he told me that it was imperative for people working in tech to realize that they're building for something beyond themselves, their families and communities, he said. Technology is so powerful right now that you need to have this sort of touch grass moment. People are so ready to make AGI their god, Tan added. What we're trying to do with events like this is give them an alternative. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Toni Collette. The actor and Mickey 17 star on Travel Regrets, Acupuncture, and Jumping into the Ocean. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Chastity. Pointless. Who came up with that? On what occasion do you lie to my dentist about the regularity of my flossing? What is your idea of perfect happiness, floating on my back in the ocean? What is your greatest extravagance? Flights to Italy. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? This is the best thing I've ever eaten. And hilarious. And Arlo, get off your phone. What is your favorite journey? Summer days spent jumping off a boat into the sea, or winter days on a train? Both, preferably in Italy. But I'll pretty much jump into any clean body of water. Which living person do you most admire? Anyone brave enough to truly be themselves. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I'm terribly impatient. What is your greatest regret? Saying no to being the face of Qantas when I was 22. I'd only made 2 films and wanted to be taken seriously as an actor. I live to travel. What an idiot. Shall we regroup? What is your greatest fear? Losing my mind. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I'm not religious, but I think Jesus was the coolest. What is the trait you most deplore in others? People-pleasing. Which living person do you most despise? Ignorant presidents, plural. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Besides my children, who own my heart, I am lucky to have loved and been loved. Real love is everything and very rare. When and where were you happiest? Right now, summer, dusk, on my couch, watching Australian Open tennis with my kids and dog. Doors wide open to a beautiful body of water. The first star of the night just appeared in the sky. Life is magical. What is your current state of mind, post-acupuncture stoned? If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? Nah, it's taken a while, but I accept it all. What do you regard as the lowest depth of misery? Feeling truly alone. Because we are actually and ultimately all very much connected, whether we acknowledge it or not. If you could change one thing about your family, what would it be? Maybe we'd add a cat, a pig, some chickens. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Maud from Hal Ashby's film Harold and Maude. She's authentic, wild, and not afraid of life or death. Who are your heroes in real life? People who are naturally inclined to help others. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? An effective peacemaker. What is your most treasured possession? Notes from my kids. What is it that you most dislike? Smoking, moronic, and selfish. Don't contaminate everyone else's air while you slowly commit suicide. Where would you like to live? Totally immersed in nature. What is your favorite occupation? My own. I have loved it for 35 years and counting. What is your most marked characteristic? For better or worse, I am somewhat impulsive. Who are your favorite writers? Rumi, Hafez, Elizabeth Strout, James Baldwin, Anton Chekhov, Marcus Aurelius, Tim Winton, Donna Tartt, Miriam Toews, Elizabeth Gilbert, too many. What are your favorite names? Sage and Arlo. What is your motto? Keep your heart open. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Toni Collette. the family business together. Orrin and Tal Alexander formed one of America's premier real estate teams with billions of dollars in sales. Elon, Orrin's twin, helped run their father's private security firm. Now they await criminal trial in a Brooklyn jail, facing multiple accusations of rape and assault from women across the country. Willem Marks reports on the fall of the Alexander brothers. Opening photo, Orrin and Elon Alexander, accused of rape by multiple women and charged with federal and state crimes, attend their bond hearing on December 13th in Miami. Jane left her two sisters and a friend napping at their hotel, resting up for the New Year's Eve festivities. It was late afternoon by the time the Uber dropped her alone at the Miami Beach apartment building, with its lobby of marble and dark wood and an elegant pool backing out onto the sand. Elon, the tall, handsome, successful man she'd been excited to see a third time, had texted her a picture of a barbecue in full swing. He came down to meet her, greeting her with a hug, and up they went. The elevator opened into an airy apartment with floor-to-ceiling windows, where two other men stood beside a kitchen island. One of them, Orrin, was Elon's identical twin. Elon introduced her to the other, Ohad, as their cousin. But Jane was immediately confused. There was no sign of any other guest. No barbecue apparent at all. Nonetheless, the group made small talk for several minutes before Elon beckoned her to follow him to another room. She had matched with him over the summer on Bumble while she was living in New York. They had a mutual acquaintance from her college days in Orlando. They'd first met for drinks at his sprawling Soho loft, and they had sex, consensually, and again, just after a Carrie Underwood concert. They'd reconnected after realizing they were both in Miami Beach for the holiday. Jane hoped the invitation that afternoon indicated Elon might consider her more than just a casual hookup. But as she followed him through the doorway to a bedroom, shooing away a maid, Jane suddenly understood she was not being given a tour of the apartment. And then Ohad and Orrin walked in, single file. Orrin closed and locked the door. Ohad clambered onto the bed, pulled Jane back by the shoulders, then pinned her upper arms beneath his knees. It was like a ritual thing, she recalls now. Everyone knew what to do. Terrified, her heart rate spiked and tears began to pour as Orrin, speaking nonchalantly to Elon about who's going to go first, despite Jane's clear distress, wrestled off her jean shorts and bikini bottom, took off his own pants, and rolled on a condom. "Please don't," she cried out as he painfully penetrated her, turning toward Elon, who had taken a seat next to the bed and watched in silence. "They were just completely ignoring me," she recalls. "I was there, but I wasn't there." She thought feigning enjoyment might bring the nightmare to an end faster, but her pretense seemed to irritate Orrin. Muttering, "F this," he ripped off the prophylactic and stormed out. Jane began to cry hysterically. Elon then stood, put on his own condom, and began to rape her too, as she continued to sob. After he finished, he fell back onto the chair and casually picked up his phone. Without looking up, he addressed her for the first time since they had entered the room. "We're not leaving here until you F my cousin," he said, referring to Ohad. "Please no, please no, please no," Jane remembers begging him. "Well," he relented, "you have to at least give him head." She continued to refuse, whimpering, until Elon gave up and ordered her into a shower. As she left the apartment, Elon dashed up with a towel around his waist and kissed her on the cheek with a warning, "Don't tell anybody about this." She took an Uber back to the hotel, where she slumped in another shower, barely able to breathe, and told her sisters everything. Now, 8 years later, Jane's allegations, recounted in more starched legalese, form part of an indictment against Elon and Orrin Alexander, issued on December 11th by Florida's Miami-Dade state attorney. The same day, the U.S. Attorney for New York's Southern District charged the twins and an older brother, Tal, with 3 counts of sex trafficking offenses, including a conspiracy involving all 3 from at least 2010 through at least 2021. Prosecutors say they have interviewed at least 60 women and have accused each of the 3 brothers of violent, forcible rape of at least 10 women each, leaving their victims frightened that the alleged assailants might hurt or even kill them, or hunt them down afterward if they divulge their experiences. Right after those criminal charges landed, Jane Doe became one of what, at the time of publication, are 17 women to have filed civil lawsuits against Oren, Elon, and Tal, alleging sexual assault or rape. All of those suits remain open, except for one that included all 3 brothers, which a New York judge has dismissed due to a missed filing deadline. The accuser plans to appeal. Oren, Elon, and Tal have maintained their innocence, as has Ohad Fisherman, whose attorney Jeffrey Sloman told Vanity Fair that Fisherman denies the allegations in the state charges, as well as Jane Doe's civil case, noting that Fisherman is not a relative of the Alexander brothers. Through his attorney, Howard Shrebnick, Elon said, "The only sexual encounters I have had in my lifetime have been consensual and legal." Through Jennifer Wilson, his counsel, Oren denied ever raping anyone, adding, "These character-smearing attacks, many of which result from plaintiffs' lawyers, recruiting efforts, and individuals seeking to personally profit at my expense, will not hold up in court." Deanna Paul, an attorney for Tal, told Vanity Fair her client had never raped or sexually assaulted anyone, and that no number of false allegations or salacious media coverage changed that reality. All 4 men have pleaded not guilty to all charges. Denied bail in their federal criminal case, the 3 Alexander brothers sit in a Brooklyn jail, awaiting trial currently scheduled for January 2026. It's a far, fast fall from the peak of their recent status as a high-powered real estate family. Tal and Oren had become 2 of America's leading brokers amid a sea of reality TV-powered super sales. They helped sell a $238 million Central Park apartment to hedge fund titan Ken Griffin and became go-to agents for bold-faced names, including Kim Kardashian and Kanye West, and Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump. Elon, a graduate of New York Law School, helped expand the family's private security business from Miami to New York and across the country. In 2022, the New York Times profiled Tal and Oren for a piece titled "How 2 Luxury Real Estate Agents Spend Their Sundays." A month later, the Wall Street Journal splashed an exclusive on all 3 brothers selling a shared property in a story titled "Real Estate Power Brokers List Miami Beach Home for $31.5 million. The following spring, Vogue featured Oren's wedding to a Brazilian model, sharing details of his Aspen proposal and their 350-person engagement party during Miami's Art Basel week. But beneath the trappings of luxury was a much darker story. Over the course of several months, Vanity Fair spoke to dozens of sources, including many of the accusers, as well as friends and business associates, to paint a picture of staggering contrast. The brothers Alexander, shining testaments to American wealth, winning public recognition at charity galas. The brothers Alexander, who have allegedly perpetrated years of sexual violence, leaving deep emotional trauma and outright terror in their wake. Throughout their time at Dr. Michael M. Kropp Senior High School in North Miami, the Alexander twins and their tennis star brother, Tal, had reputations for arrogance and hard partying, and ran with a small clique of other highly privileged boys. At luxurious homes and gated communities, according to a number of high school contemporaries, The brothers and their friends hosted large gatherings with minimal parental supervision, where young people used kitchen counters to crush and snort benzos, downing booze by the handle. Occasionally, some of the boys would retire to dimly lit, beautifully appointed bedrooms for sexual encounters that were rarely private, say multiple sources, frequently recorded on camera, and not always consensual, with girls who were not always conscious. One woman remembers a drunken teenage makeout session with Alon at the brothers' home in upscale Bal Harbor. Oren had stopped at the doorway and asked a question in Hebrew. Alon translated it for her. He wanted to go get the video camera, and I said no, she recalls him explaining. Other girls, according to multiple sources, did not receive the same reprieve. The Alexanders and their friends would arrive at parties in small convoys of luxury cars, say the contemporaries, BMW X5s and Cadillac Escalades, with DVD screens on seatbacks playing porn, including recordings of their own exploits. When the twins were sophomores, they began hanging out with a group of freshman girls every other weekend. One of those girls, who has since pursued a medical career and who hasn't spoken about her experiences until now, hooked up with Alon while her friend fooled around with Oren. Occasionally, the Alexanders' parents would be home and react angrily to the goings-on, the woman says. But the twins had bedrooms on the ground floor of the 6,000-square-foot house, far from where their parents slept, and spent unsupervised time at a nearby unfurnished property that their father, Shlomo, known as Shlomi, was developing. The Alexander parents did not respond to a list of detailed questions sent to them by Vanity Fair. At some point during this period, Alon began to invite other teenage boys into the room when they had sex, the woman says, over her stated objections. But during a months-long period in 2002, she began losing control of her faculties and memory in the twins' company. She now suspects her drinks were being spiked. It started off just being kind of just normal, she recalls. It ended up escalating to like, you no longer essentially would remember the night, or you would remember essentially just little bits and pieces of the night. Ask if boys other than Alon, including Oren and Tal, may have had sex with her while she was unconscious, had raped her. Her response was immediate. Probably, 100%. Once she learned from friends that the brothers and their buddies were bragging about having sex with her, or from her point of view, raping her when she was passed out, she says that she and her friends stopped hanging out with them. But the reputational damage was done. Throughout high school, actual dating was a lot more difficult, the woman says, probably because of what happened my freshman year. She warned other young women at Krupp to avoid the Alexanders, calling them scumbags. When she heard about the allegations against the brothers over the summer of 2024, she was initially shocked that they could have continued for so long. But then a grim realization set in. I guess it kind of makes sense, she explains. They never really had any kind of consequences. Alon told Vanity Fair he has never drugged a woman, nor had sex with a woman who I believed was drugged. Oren said he'd never drugged anyone, and any person saying otherwise is lying. Another Krupp alum went to a house party of a friend of the twins when they were all juniors. She had only drunk a small amount, she recalls. But her memory is patchy, fused with accounts shared with her by friends. She now believes she was drugged. In one flash of memory, she was upstairs with Tal, who at the time was a stranger. She had no idea the dark-haired twins in her grade had a blonde older brother. In another flash of memory, he was suddenly on top of her in a pitch-black bedroom. In addition to a blanket denial of claims against him, Tal says he has never drugged anyone. She regained consciousness in the back of an SUV belonging to a guy she knew with her underwear around her thighs. That's when I knew, like, immediately, and I freaked out. She began to shout at the boy driving to stop the car. Why am I waking up like this? Like, what happened? What happened? It was clear she had been raped, she shouted. But the others in the vehicle got mad and shouted at her. You're accusing us of being involved, she recalls them saying. Later, a friend's mother, who was a nurse, took a blood sample to test for STDs or pregnancy. Fearful of personal consequences, she didn't report it to police. We're doing drugs and we're drinking, she says, thinking back to that time. We're doing things that we're not supposed to be doing anyway. While the twins were sophomores in high school, they and Tal were among the subjects of a police investigation after a 14-year-old girl, who confirmed certain details to Vanity Fair, reported an encounter to her school counselor, and the counselor informed police. The police report, which is redacted in places, documents that the girl became frantic and began to cry hysterically at school after rumors emerged she had had sex with seven guys while she had been under the influence of Xanax and alcohol. She reported she had been sexually battered by several males, that she had bitten the penis of one of the males when she was asked to give him oral sex, that she had been unconscious at other points, and that she was unsure she had ever given consent to multiple males. She said she had only wanted to engage with one of them. Accompanied by one of her parents, she was examined at a rape crisis center and her belongings were impounded. But based on the facts that the males admitted to having consensual intercourse and the fact that the victim's statements were inconsistent during the interviews, reads the report, the charges of sexual battery were ultimately dropped, and no arrests were made. As I pointed at a white dry erase board located in the same room, I asked victim that if it would be the truth or a lie if I told her that the board was green in color, an officer emphatically recounts in the report. The victim replied it would be a lie. I then asked her if it was good or bad to lie, and she replied bad. The girl left CROP later that year, in part because of the alleged assaults, and moved to Key West. She initially informed police that Tal, Oren, and Alon had been among the boys involved. But even though she believed she had been raped, she told Vanity Fair by phone, as a teenager, she had been worried about her social standing. If I got them in trouble, or whoever in trouble that was involved, then I would lose my friends, she says now. I didn't want to lose my friends, because I had just made some of these friends. It was a privileged bunch of privileged kids, recalls a classmate. They got to do whatever they want, they say whatever they want, without any consequences. After CROP, Tal went to college in New York. A year later, Oren headed off to the University of Colorado in Boulder and Alon to the University of Maryland. The brother's real estate origin myth, oft repeated, involves the most expensive single home transaction in Miami history at the time and came courtesy of their hard-charging father. Israel-born Shlomi co-founded Kent Security, which provides private guards, home surveillance, and property management services. But he began developing luxury homes when his sons were still teenagers. In the late 2000s and early 2010s, he had focused on one spectacular property, 3 Indian Creek, which he originally bought with a partner for $10 million in 2007, then renovated and promoted all over the place, including a segment on ABC News' Nightline. In 2012, a wealthy Moscow businessman visiting Miami with his wife and son was on the hunt for a trophy home. He wanted at least 20,000 square feet, with a large waterside plot, high security, and maximum privacy. One morning, brokers took him to the imposing, recently finished property on Indian Creek, listed at $52 million. During the viewing, according to two people familiar with the transaction, the buyer's son, who was in his 20s, asked the seller's agent about the seller's identity. Next photo. Alon and Oren at a 2011 costume party in Watermill, New York. And in another photo, Tal Oren and Alon at a 2015 birthday celebration in New York City. The son remarked he had previously met Oren Alexander at a nightclub. A few minutes later, Shlomi himself arrived to join the tour. And soon enough, buyer and seller had made a dinner date for that evening, without telling the buyer's brokers. Oren hopped on a plane down from New York to join the meal, and that night struck a deal for $47 million, with Oren slated to be the buyer's agent of record. But when the buyer learned from a friend that this was not the way U.S. property transactions were typically executed, and after one original broker threatened to raise hell through their powerful multinational employer, the Alexanders faced a reckoning. After an awkward and sometimes heated meeting the next day in the presidential suite of the St. Regis Bal Harbor, father and son backed down, slightly. On top of his share of the selling commission, Oren would now walk away with only half of the buyer's agent fee, $500,000, a sizable payday for a night of schmoozing with his dad. He immediately informed the New York Post that he, alone, had been responsible for bringing the buyer to the table. By that point, Tal and Oren had become frequent fodder in the press, as the high-end markets in New York, Miami, and Los Angeles were exploding. Real estate agents went from being just kind of service providers to these people who live in this strange alternate universe, where they believe themselves often to be some kind of semi-celebrity, says Rob Jim, a California broker whom Tal once spent months trying to recruit. Aside from being ridiculous and distasteful, it's not real. The brothers certainly seem to enjoy a lavish lifestyle, with Alon frequently along for the ride, which they documented in great detail on Instagram. Industry peers and impressionable young women alike saw them sailing on yachts and lounging on jets, typically belonging to their far wealthier clients, bringing the party and eye candy wherever they went. Tal ultimately focused mostly on the market in New York, where the Alexander team was selling many of the city's newest buildings, including a tower at 57th Street and Park Avenue, at the time the tallest residential building in the world. He rented a place for himself there and invited women he met on a dating app over for dinner. He warned one woman, then in her early 20s, not to post photos of the space's 15-foot ceilings before telling her during a game of backgammon that he liked rough sex. After dinner at the restaurant downstairs, Tal issued what felt like an ultimatum. "If you're not going to have sex with me, you should just leave," the woman recalls him saying. "So I left." Oren, meanwhile, perfected the South Florida lifestyle, playing paddleball, kite surfing, and wooing girls on big boats. Miami was a small world for the young, rich, and beautiful. Oren often messaged models on the same social media platforms, like Instagram and Facebook, that he and Tal used to build their business. Some of the women believed that Oren kept screenshots of their communication with him as leverage to throw back in their faces if they ever accused him of anything untoward. In one civil suit filed late last year in Colorado, a woman alleged Alon had raped her in Aspen as a 17-year-old, then minutes later opened her phone, followed himself on Instagram from her account, then sent himself a message as if from her that read, "Hey, babe." The Facebook messages that Maria Suska received in April 2014 were unusually direct, though Oren was kind of handsome and friends with others she knew from the Miami party scene. "I leave to L.A. on Saturday, but let's meet before," he wrote to the Polish-American model and cardiac nurse. After a brief back and forth, Suska agreed to have dinner that week with the courteous stranger who invited her to Zuma, a high-end Japanese restaurant. Suska was surprised when she arrived the following night to find two other men and nine women at Oren's table. She assumed they were going on a traditional date, just the two of them. He was flirty and touchy throughout dinner as he fed her sushi, winking and smiling, but not really engaging in actual conversation. The other women barely spoke, but Suska decided to accompany Aaron and several fellow diners to another party, hoping to get to know him better. When Suska, Aaron, and the others arrived at the Versace mansion, a security guard took her phone and warned there could be no photos before directing the group to a poolside patio area with catering but no music. Aaron vanished, but Elon soon arrived, jumping into the water nude and yelling at women around the pool to join him. When nobody accepted his invitation, Elon exited angrily, dried himself off, and got dressed, as Aaron reappeared by Suska's side. He asked if she wanted to check out the view from the building's tower. You can see it in the Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story, and they ascended its narrow staircase. Suska still hoped for a romantic moment, maybe a kiss at the top. Instead, as she entered the small space with no lights or furniture, Oren's charm vanished, aggression in its place. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.